Radio Free America, and this is Uncle Sam with music and the truth until dawn. Right now, I got a few words for some of our brothers and sisters in the occupied zone. The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache. It's 12 o'clock, Americans, another day closer to victory. And for all of you out there on or behind the lines, this is your song.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome.
I have a joke for you.
Okay.
The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
I thought you'd see it coming. The moment here, they come to come as much as they feel.
Bitcoin is immune from attack almost completely. With Bitcoin, you actually gain far more from using that computing power to generate Bitcoin.
There's a system approaching perfection. It's in time for our disappearance. There's a system approaching perfection. It's in time for our disappearance.
We'll walk deeper into the belly of the beast if it means I'm able to further limit reckless government spending. I mean, I have so many ideas. Some are simple, like take down traffic lights and eliminate the post office. The bigger ones will be tougher, like bring all of this crumbling.
Hey, hey, welcome to the crypto show. Undermine the bank and the man. Have some fun while we do it, do it, do it, do it. Hey, hey, welcome to the crypto show. Undermine the bank and the man. Have some fun while we do it, do it, do it.
Oh yeah, welcome guys to the latest episode of the Crypto Show. It is Sunday, August 7th, 2016, here on Logos Radio Network. And don't forget, as always, I encourage you to go to logosradionetwork.com and keep this listener-supported network going. And if you couldn't figure out from what I just said how that happens, you donate and give of charitably of yourself to the extent that you can in Federal Reserve notes. Gold, silver, or Bitcoin, or, well, I won't say other cryptocurrencies, probably not, but definitely Bitcoin. And don't forget our sponsors, Hill Country Home Improvements, and Crypto Compare with the Crypto Compare News Minute. Before I roll out with our guests, I'm going to throw out a Crypto Compare News Minute for your listening pleasure. All right, BTCe calls out Ethereum Classic as a scam. BTCe has officially announced that it will not add Ethereum Classic and it will not credit users with ETC balances, exchanges like Kraken and Poloniex did. The announcement was made through the BTCe website. BTCe's official standpoint on this issue is as follows. Ethereum Classic in the current circumstances is a scam. The Ethereum community decided to implement the hard fork in order to switch to the new chain. All major pools and exchanges, including BTCe, did exactly that. On the second day after the start of ETC trading, BTCe received a notification from Poloniex saying that, quote, we need to secure the ETCs in our ETH wallet. At the time of notification, most of these coins have already been sent to Poloniex by our users. So there were almost none of these coins in our wallet. Well, that's a good, I think, starting point, actually. I kind of want to ask our guests what they think about the opinion, and clearly that's all it is an opinion that Ethereum Classic is a scam. And originally one of our guests was going to be John McAfee, but we had to postpone with him until Wednesday. So look forward to that. That's very exciting. We're going to have John McAfee on. I'm already cracking up because he's always a hilarious guest. But we're going to have him on Wednesday with Chris Odom of Stash. And Chris is actually in studio with us, at least for the first half, for this episode. And Chris, how are you tonight?
I can't stay long.
He can't stay long. He always says that to keep the boys and girls wanting more. But we also have Brian Deary, chief scientist and Dances with Bitcoin, is his given name when he was born. But chief scientist of Factum, Brian, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
Do you still go by your given name, your birth name?
It's very special to me.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that. Excellent. It's not actually his birth name, the crypto. It's his rebirth name.
I went to his office looking for him, and I asked for Dances with Bitcoins, and no one knew who I was talking about.
So. Is that true?
They were out of town when he gotten the names.
Well, they're not enlightened yet. That's their problem, not his.
Yeah, the question in my mind is not whether or not it's a scam. It's what was
I kind of missed what you said about not, something about not crediting users.
I couldn't quite get that either. Honestly, I think the wording on what I was reading was a little off. Let me see.
Here's what I'm thinking. If the Ethereum blockchain forks,
right,
and so you have a bunch of balances here and a bunch of balances here, are they saying we're not giving our users back their balances on this side of the fork, only this side?
They should have both sides,
they should
right?
have both. And normally, yeah, so if they're holding their own wallet, they would have both. Are they saying, yeah, we're going to give you this, but we're not going to give you this? Because I would think that would be actionable.
Yeah, it's basically theft, right?
Well, I mean, wouldn't you have a cause for action? Normally I would have this, and they have half of it and won't give it back to me.
And see, I don't know if it's stipulated in their some contract clause.
In their terms?
In their terms, rather.
If there's a fork, we're not responsible for the side
but
fork.
But I don't know if that would be the case. And you would think if that was the case that they would throw that out there in this sort of announcement.
I mean, I'd be pissed. Krawitz has a new article. I don't know if he's released it yet, but he's got a new article about which fork he thinks is going to win, and he thinks the classic one's going to win.
Really?
Which, you know, if it loses, then, you know, no skin off my nose. But if I had a bunch of those units, and then that turned out to be the fork that succeeded long term, and they didn't give me my coins, I'd be pissed.
I would too. Yeah. So, and just to clarify that, so when a fork happens, if you have a fork of that cryptocurrency in your wallet, you should now have both. Simultaneously, right?
I mean, you still have the key for both,
right?
It's just, you know, two different blockchains now, but it's the same key for both of them.
And you can make action on both blockchains.
I would presume.
With that key, yeah.
If they're doing it right, then when you make an action on one blockchain, it makes an identical action on the other blockchain. And so you have to actively take effort to not have it affect both blockchains.
So, and again, we're kind of ignorant of exactly what the situation is here, like why they're not giving users both blockchains or coins. But it makes you wonder, okay, we talked about user agreement, maybe, but it's clearly this has been a heated debate and very political. Like on both sides of the debate, and I think especially on the Ethereum side, they really want Ethereum Classic to fail. And they're dragging out rhetoric like scam, which is silly. It's not a scam. Like, that is a very ridiculous.
It's a fork.
It's a fork, yeah. And
it was a planned fork.
It's a planned fork, and while the majority may have gone with Ethereum Classic is still the original, and it still abides by the original intent, which was to be immutable. So to call, you know, if anything, you could argue Ethereum, the new Ethereum, is the scam. Because it's violating the conditions set forth in the original Ethereum. I don't want to say paper.
I think they're calling out the scam maybe is the exchange is doing it.
I wouldn't be tossing around words like scam anyway.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. I don't know. That's something. Well, Brian, go ahead.
Yeah. So in my mind, this is this basically demonstrates that cryptocurrency is political money. It's democratic money. And that it's what the community agrees on. Jameson Lopp wrote an excellent article about forks on CoinDesk a few weeks ago. And he examined all the, through history, what the different forks with different altcoins happened. and it didn't really, historically they turned out poorly.
Now, did it turn out poorly for the fork or for the currency in general?
For the currency in general.
Oh, okay.
But these were small cryptocurrencies to begin with.
Right.
But the point is it's what the community decides. So if everyone in Bitcoin decided, hey, 22 million Bitcoins is the appropriate number, then if everyone started running that software, then everyone would upgrade to 22 million Bitcoins.
Well, here's the thing. I don't disagree with you, and I don't agree with you at the same time, in the sense of I do agree that Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies are sort of democratic and I guess as close to market democracy as you can get. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't be that way and the community shouldn't speak, but at the same time, can the community be wrong is my question. And I feel, and this is my personal opinion.
Yes.
I feel the community was wrong in this case, and they can be wrong. And so you say yes. So in that case, what does that mean when a majority decides on a fork like
this? Well, this is the magic of Bitcoin. Bitcoin makes it extremely expensive to disagree with the majority. So not just expensive politically, but expensive thermodynamically.
But it's not. It's not the majority of people. It's the majority of people trying to not lose money by telling the truth. You know, like that's what a miner does. A miner is spending money, and if he tells the truth, he makes money. And if he lies, it still costs him money to do it. But then people just ignore it. You know, and so it's like you're either telling the truth and being paid for it, or not telling the truth and losing a bunch of money to do so. You know, so it's not just like a Democratic vote where it's just a 51% majority.
I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
You've got a profit and a loss analysis that, or you've got that going against you as well. The very real prospect and likelihood of losing money. Except in this case, I mean, obviously, the majority of the miners joined with Ethereum, and they didn't lose money, I guess, in that sense. Right. Or,
you know, here's what Krawitz's analysis was, that at least from I could tell from reading his article, was he said, you know, if you compare two different currencies, like an altcoin, like Bitcoin and Litecoin or something like that, or Bitcoin and Dogecoin, then there's sort of a different set of factors at play versus two chains from a fork. Because with Bitcoin and Dogecoin, you know, you have to sort of sell some Bitcoin and buy the Dogecoin and pick one or the other, and you're kind of going based on which chain you think is better. But with a fork, you already have the same exact units on both sides, so you have nothing to lose, right? And if you're going to go from that point and choose one chain over the other, it might be for different criteria than what you might pick an altcoin with. And Krawitz's argument was that the criteria you would use in the case of a fork is basically which one is irreversible.
Okay, well, hence, as you mentioned already, Krawitz's prediction that Classic would ultimately win out.
Yeah, for you know, specific logical reasons. In fact, he had predicted it a long time ago. He had predicted this sort of thing happening with regard to Bitcoin. And so now he's really happy to see that maybe a test case has occurred where he can prove out his theory that he had predicted in a previous article.
I can see his thumb stroking his ego.
Yeah.
Right now. More credit to him for doing that. Mm-hmm. He's been Scrooge McAlcoin has been right many, many times. So it has only benefited the community when he promotes his rightness in these well-written papers that he puts out. In fact, John Vagy is working on putting some of those in audiobook, and it's a testament to how right he has been. We've got a minute till break. One thing I was going to ask real quick, and not to take this topic on too long, but, well, you get both coins at first, but once you use them, or, well, you have both coins. Let's say you have coins in your wallet. Obviously, right. If you spend them, then you could just keep them all.
You could keep them all, or you could sell one and buy more of the other, or that's sell true. That one and buy
or
more of the
versa,
other.
Or vice versa, yeah.
And why would you do
actually,
that?
Actually, when I think about it, yeah, it really, in that sense, isn't such a bad thing.
And, like, if when you go and make that decision to do that buy or sell, it's not based on, like, oh, I think Dogecoin has a future. It's not like that. It's like, you know, I sort of already have it, and the properties are basically identical between the two. The only thing that's different between the two is this irreversibility. They're otherwise identical currencies.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
So is that important? Is it important that a currency be hard?
I think it is. And we'll talk more about that. I also want to know what you think of the prospect of an attack on Ethereum Classic, which people have talked about. So when we come back, we'll talk about that with Dances with Bitcoin and Chris Odom from Stash. Stay tuned.
I want to talk about fund.lrn.fm. Some of the biggest names in Bitcoin have credited Free Talk Live and lrn.fm as being the source of information where they first learned about Bitcoin, like Roger Ver and Anthony DiOrio. The Crypto Show is proud to be featured on lrn.fm and fully supports fund.lrn.fm, an Indiegogo campaign to help continue spreading the word about Bitcoin via satellite in North and Central America, as well as Sub-Saharan Africa. Go to fund.lrn.fm. FM to help today. And yes, you can donate Bitcoin. That's fund.lrn.fm to spread the word worldwide. This Indiegogo ends August 19th. fund.lrn.fm.
What
that time again. The third annual Anarchapulco 2017, February 23rd through the 26th. And this time, it's bigger and better than ever. There's a reason why we keep going back every year. Because it's a blast. Which is the same reason the speakers keep coming back too. Roger Ver, Jeffrey Tucker, Stephanie Murphy, Tone Vase, Derek J, Julia Turiansky, Adam Kokesh, Larkin Rose, and the list goes on and on. Much more to be announced soon. Don't forget to save some dough by using the coupon code CRYPTO. Un verso puro dall'alma. That's right. Be sure to use the coupon code CRYPTO at anarchapulco.com.
Welcome back, guys, to the Crypto Show here on this lovely Sunday, August 7th, 2016.
The last segment wore him out.
Man, it was tough. It was hard. It's just when you go a few days without doing this, it's like you completely forget it, and it's like running on a treadmill. Woo! Anyway, welcome back. We're talking with Brian Deary, a.k.a. Dances with Bitcoin, Chief Scientist of Factum, and Chris Odom, creator of Open Transactions and one of the guys at Stash. And he will also be on the show this upcoming Wednesday, the 10th, with John McAfee. Anyway, we do have a couple extra
John
guests.
John McAfee and Eric from EJA.
Oh, yeah, EJA. EJA from Demonsaw. He's a great guy, really smart. Can't wait to have him on. Well, we have a couple guests on the line. We'll get to them in a moment. But I do want to finish out the thought we had in the second or in the first segment, which was, well, first of all, were there any other insights in Krawitz's paper that are worth sharing that you can recall?
Hey, I don't want to ruin the suspense. Everyone's going to have to read it for themselves.
And where did they go? Is it?
He's definitely entertaining. He's always entertaining.
He is always entertaining. And I forget, is it the Nakamoto Institute?
Yeah.
That's the one.
Is it NakamotoInstitute.com?
I don't know for sure. Probably.
Well, just Google
it's dot, whatever it is, it's .org.
.org. Okay. Yeah. Well, so what do you think of the odds or of the idea that – so, of course, one thing that is of maybe negative consequence, correct me if I'm wrong, is when there's a split, there's also a split in the hashing power, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And so that
only
is
– only for a period of time. So this has to do with the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Uh-huh.
So Ethereum has a retargeting period that's much shorter than Bitcoin. So it becomes, as time goes on, it gets easier and easier to have a usable chain. And so
after a split or
after a split, yes.
Okay.
And so after a relatively short period of time, both of them are fully usable and tolerable for the to the users. And this is dramatically different than Bitcoin, where it takes 2 weeks to change and become usable. So if 10% of the hash power remained in the minority chain, it would take 20 weeks to get back to normal. And you'd have 100-minute blocks in that time period, which to me seems unusable.
100-minute blocks?
100-minute blocks if with a split.
That'd be a good name for a band.
I would, actually. I like that. Somebody needs to come. We just have a whole show of Bitcoin-related band names. That'd be kind of cool.
I've always wanted to start a band called the Cypherpunks. That'd be pretty cool, huh?
Has that not been taken? I'm surprised that hasn't been taken.
I don't know. Yeah, no one ran with it.
Interesting. They have that website. We should check. I'm going to do that on break, actually. Oh, wait. So, Chris, is this true? Or wait, so it'll automatically get up to its old hashing speed, hashing power, after a certain amount of time?
Yeah. So
without any new hardware coming online?
It self-corrects. So Bitcoin self-corrects,
right,
and Ethereum self-corrects. Ethereum self-corrects a lot faster than Bitcoin.
Okay.
And therefore now the Ethereum chain that is that was the minority chain is now much more usable than if the equivalent thing happened.
Well, I guess put it this way. Forgive me. This is a corollary of what you just
You're
said.
Saying that someone could come in and squish it with a majority of hashing power, right? Yeah. Someone could come in with all the hashing power and squish it like great.
Yeah. And basically, like, I mean, is that equivalent to the security being the extent it was before? And someone could just come along and squish it, right? If if after a fork and there's a huge disparity between the one and the other, or not even. I mean, but if it's drastically reduced.
If it's drastically different, then yes. This was one of the security assumptions that Satoshi taught us early on.
You make it sound like a cult, man.
It's kind of a cult.
Just kidding.
That whoever has the majority hash power wins.
Okay. And so, I don't want to belabor this too much. So I guess last question then. Are we to expect maybe an attack on Ethereum Classic, as some people have predicted or even called for? Or what? What do you think?
I can't comment. I wouldn't know.
I wouldn't do anything like that.
Okay, well, that was a fruitful line of questioning.
It costs money to do it, right? Someone has to be willing to lose money to do it. But I just don't know enough to give an expert answer to that question.
No, fair enough. I will say that at the very least, the call for it and the rumor of it, while is a reasonable thing to speculate on or for people to possibly expect, you can also see it as... it may never happen, but it is a political move to undermine confidence in ETC when people are calling for or expecting an attack on ETC. So that, I think that in a purely psychological or political way is interesting. So
people are calling for an attack?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, literally.
It's like Iraq or something like that. People are calling for an attack.
They even called it shock and awe. I mean, I was... surprised how real world they're getting about this. No, but it's just like with BTCE, and I forget the guy's name, calling ETC a scam. The supporters of Ethereum are getting pretty dogged in their...
So this does teach us a lot, because people were talking about how a split in Bitcoin, the dramatic negative effects that would happen, and we are learning firsthand the dramatic negative effects that happen when you have a split like this.
That's true.
And so it teaches us to be much more careful about having a split in the community.
Yeah. And I mean, and just look at, without a split, all the drama that was going on with Bitcoin about the block size debate. But you're right. It is good at having another cryptocurrency experience it and have the fallout and have that as a sort of microcosm test case scenario before we have that with Bitcoin. Maybe that'll teach us some stuff that we can avoid.
So what they do is they don't give people back a bunch of their coins, and then they call it a scam. Right? Like, we're not going to give you any of these coins. That's statement one. Statement two, this is a scam.
It's pretty childish, if you ask me. I mean, again, they're sticking with the principles of immutability that theoretically underpin all cryptocurrencies philosophically. And then even with, I don't know what they were calling it, but some of the early documents basically on Ether use the word immutability.
This water's a scam.
Well, it's a scam now because you took it from me.
Well, we keep talking about scammers and the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, and there's an excellent article from a couple years back about how everyone's a scammer.
Interesting. Well, we have a minute left, so I want to get to our guests on the other side. That's why I was kind of waiting. I realized we didn't have much time until the end of the break. But tell us about that real quick as we go out to break, if you can.
Oh, about how everyone's a scammer?
Yeah.
Oh, it's been a while since I read it. But so all the people who have Bitcoins think that they're tricking other vendors into giving them valuable goods for these worthless Bitcoins. And so that's kind of a scam.
I think I remember this.
And then how the vendor thinks, hey, we're getting rid of this these goods, and we're going to get these valuable Bitcoins. And for them, it's kind of a scam.
So it's kind of tongue-in-cheek,
like,
is that it?
Definitely.
Yeah. I like that. It kind of harkens to, it's almost like a jab at the sort of Marxist, leftist idea that free trade is, taking someone's surplus value and all that sort of nonsense. But anyway, we're coming to break, so we'll be right back after this.
If you're tired of explaining Bitcoin or just want to know what Bitcoin is, no worries. Send your newbie friends to Bitcoin.com, the best source on the internet for experts and novices alike. With the latest news, uncensored forums, and all things Bitcoin in one location, Bitcoin.com does not welcome scammers, so you can trust your newbie friends to a safe source of information. Bitcoin.com is constantly evolving to make sure it's the most trusted source for Bitcoin information on the internet. That's Bitcoin.com.
Hi guys, welcome back to the Crypto Show here on this lovely August 7th, 2016. It is the third segment, and we just had in studio Chris Odom, creator of Open Transactions and part of Stash. He had to head out, but we're going to have him back on Wednesday with John McAfee, so that should be a good show. We're all very excited about that. He's quite a character, and he's always on the cutting edge of security matters, and as it turns out, Bitcoin. We'll talk to him about his latest Bitcoin venture, or Bitcoin related venture anyway, on Wednesday. So stay tuned for that. We got Brian Deary, aka Dances with Bitcoin, in studio with us, and I'm going to introduce our guests here in just a moment who are on the line as well. But let me do another Crypto Compare News Minute real quick. Zcash launch may be delayed. The launch of the zero knowledge cryptocurrency known as Zcash may be delayed in order to allow the code to be analyzed by multiple third-party auditors. Problems surrounding the DAO attack make security a top priority for any cryptocurrency project. Zuko Wilcox, founder of Zcash, stated, quote, "I feel bad that we didn't do a better job of making DAO disaster-like problems harder for people to encounter." All right, well, that's an interesting quote. Well, we'll get to our guests. Our guests on the line are Andrew Polstra and Peter Willa, and I hope I pronounced either of those right. Andrew, are you there?
Hey, guys. We're here.
Excellent. And I guess I'm going to let you guys give our audience a little background of yourselves. So, Andrew, I'll let you start. Tell us about yourself and what you do related to the Bitcoin space.
So I showed up in the Bitcoin space around late 2011 while I was starting a PhD in mathematics. And I wound up sort of hanging around on the research side of things, sort of like IRC channels centered around cryptography research. And these days I work on the LibSecP256K1 project, which does the underlying cryptography kind of stuff for Bitcoin Core and related projects. So that's mostly what I spend my days doing, just implementing crypto code.
That's pretty awesome. You know, this is probably one of the first or few times we've had a really hardcore cryptography person on the show. We should have you back at some point if you're willing to maybe get a little deeper into cryptography questions.
And now we have two at the same time.
But actually, as it turns out, we have two for one at the same time. Peter Willa also is a cryptography expert. And Peter, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself as well.
Sure. I discovered Bitcoin around the end of 2010, and I was immediately attracted to the development side of things. I started coding on Bitcoin, who would later become Bitcoin Core, around 2011, and now that's pretty much my full-time job, as well as working on the cryptography library that it uses.
So you're one of the core developers?
Yeah, there's no strictly good definition for that word, but I'd say yes.
That is a fair point. That is a somewhat arbitrary term to use, fair enough. But definitely a person with very deep knowledge of Bitcoin and very integral in its development. So that's pretty awesome to have on the show. Peter Willa and Andrew Polstra, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. And you were on courtesy of our in-studio Bitcoin expert who's with us here a lot, Brian Deary, of course, chief scientist of Factum. And well, actually, real quick, too, by the way, Factum has had some good news lately, haven't they?
Oh, we don't want to talk about that. No.
We can talk about that later. We'll see.
Talk about that later.
Okay. Well,
this is way more interesting.
But Brian, I know I'm getting excited. Well, tell us why you've brought the two of them on the show. What's going on?
Something really exciting happened last week. So on the same day that Bitfinex lost all that money, a mysterious Harry Potter fan who was also a world-class cryptographer who was and remains anonymous, announced a new cryptographic protocol to the world.
Was this Satoshi again?
Probably not.
Oh, okay.
Satoshi, is he?
Was it Craig Wright?
There would be a lot more swearing involved.
A lot more swearing involved? Fair enough.
But,
so new cryptographic protocol, anonymous, Harry Potter fan. And so what's it all about?
So the working title right now is, Mimblewimble, which, my research tells me is a Harry Potter spell that stops other wizards from being able to cast spells against you, which is a very fitting name for an anonymity protocol that allows you to spend money without having other people watch you using their own magic of watching you do how you spend your money.
Well, so just to clarify, I'm sorry, is this another cryptocurrency-like protocol, or how would you characterize it?
This is basically a way to... why don't we let our guests...
That sounds like a great idea.
So Andrew was the first one to poke some holes in this protocol and make a few fixes and tweaks to it. And so of all the people in the world who would come on the show, who is not hiding behind Tor or a pseudonym.
He is the most apropos, I think, yeah.
He's the world expert. So,
Andrew, could you then elaborate for us a little bit more on what Brian just introduced, this cryptographic protocol? The what is it again? Mimblewimble?
Mimblewimble.
Forgive me, I'm not as big of a Harry Potter fan as I should be. Mimblewimble, but tell us a little bit more about that, Andrew.
Sure. So, as Brian said, on Monday, I think it was, Monday evening, somebody logged on to one of our research channels and just dropped some paper from, like, a Tor address under the name Tom Elvis Jedusor, which is the name of Voldemort in the French translation of Harry Potter.
And, is that for real?
that is for wow. Real. You can find the paper online, and it's written by Voldemort. So he dropped this, he signed off, and disappeared, and that's the last that we heard from this person.
You know what it sounds like? Sorry, real quick. It just reminds me of, like, really intelligent nerds. Instead of, like, frat boys who will drop, you know, bags of you-know-what, burning you-know-what on someone's doorstep, they'll drop a white paper, you know, on, like, GitHub or something. So it's like their equivalents. I love it, but it's way better. Sorry, so go ahead. So someone dropped this paper there. And continue.
So you dropped this paper. What this paper describes is basically the cryptography behind something like Bitcoin, but not Bitcoin. So sort of you could build an altcoin with this, or more usefully, you could build like a sidechain with this. And what it is a way for a way to create transactions. Unlike in Bitcoin, where you've got this sort of Bitcoin script system, and to spend money, you have to somehow solve a Bitcoin script. It simply uses straightforward digital signatures. So you can spend money by having a secret key. You can do like a multi-signature kind of thing. But it's structured in such a way that when you create a transaction and somebody else creates a transaction, anybody can take those two transactions, combine them, and the result is just one bigger transaction. So in Bitcoin, you can't do this. You can't, if you have two transactions, they're sort of like atomic. You can't squish them together or anything like that unless you use something like CoinJoin or something, which requires the people who made the transactions in the first place to interact. So that was half of this paper. What was, here's a new way to create transactions so that anybody can just squish them together. And then instead of having blocks be a giant list of transactions, every block is just one transaction. And you can't tell which parts of the transaction correspond to different real transactions, I guess. So that's a pretty big thing for privacy and anonymity, to not have those transactions separable. Like, it takes your whole transaction graph and just sort of squishes it to one transaction per block.
I guess something to add here, this is Peter, is that what Andrew is describing, somewhere in 2013, there was another anonymous author who dropped a paper on Bitcoin Talk.
I hate to interrupt, but we're getting the music. We're coming to break. We'll talk with Andrew Polster and Peter Willa about this new discovery on the other side, so stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Such suspense.
Attention all of you LRN.FM, Bitcoin Talk Radio, or any of the other podcast network listeners out there. Be sure to check out the LTB Network, also known as Let's Talk Bitcoin, for some great informative shows on cryptocurrencies and disruptive technologies. Check out the original Let's Talk Bitcoin, Epicenter Bitcoin, The Bitcoin Game, Bitcoins and Gravy, The Tatiana Show, The Crypto Show, and Sovereign BTC. And did I mention that you get paid to listen? That's right, a podcast network that not only pays the content creators, but pays the listeners too. Learn more at letstalkbitcoin.com, where the magic word is the phrase that pays. That's letstalkbitcoin.com. And for all the LTB listeners, the magic word is spell, S-P-E-L-L, spell. I think I can spell it.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Crypto Show here on this lovely August 7th, 2016, a Sunday, here on Logos Radio Network, brought to you, as always, by Hill Country Home Improvements and Crypto Compare with the Crypto Compare News Minute. Before I forget, let me throw out our next Crypto Compare News Minute, and then we'll get back to our guests. Bitcoin Browser provides an alternative to online ads. Brave, a Bitcoin-fueled browser, has raised $4.5 million as an alternative to online ads and ad blockers. Brave offers an alternative solution by connecting users and publishers directly by allowing users to send micropayments to their favorite websites. This system allows users to have an ad-free experience while still rewarding content creators and publishers. Brave software founder and CEO Brendan Eich said, "We want win-win for users and publishers. We put users first, but we want publishers to earn a better share than what they receive with traditional ad blocking." I do like this idea of giving content creators more power and more money compared to the current dinosaur system. Of course, the current dinosaur system has a lot of statist government intervention that I think benefits certain groups at the expense of others, whereas in a more free market as created by technologies like this, you have a more sort of egalitarian share, for lack of a better word, not to imply anything Marxist, that benefits everybody all the more. Anyway, let's get away from my philosophy and get back to our guests. Now, we were talking with Andrew Polstra and Peter Willa about a new cryptographic protocol that was
Mimblewimble.
Thank you. Is that Polish? No, that's right. It's
Potish.
It's Potish. That's right. There you go. at least they laugh. That's good. So this new protocol, just to remind ourselves and our listeners, so basically it can combine transactions, and not just like one and another transaction, but you're saying it can combine all transactions within a single block. Is that right?
Before we get too far, Peter was making a point.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry, Peter. Yeah. Sorry. Continue with that point.
Sure. So Andrew was explaining how this mechanism allows transactions to be combined together. And this is a mechanism that was actually described 3 years ago by another anonymous author who dropped a paper anonymously on Bitcoin Talk forum called OWASP. So the difference is that OWASP required a new type of cryptography called pairing crypto, which is not that well trusted in the academic space yet. And Mimblewimble accomplishes the same thing as what OWASP did, but more, and doesn't need these new assumptions, which are simply uses elliptic curve cryptography like Bitcoin is already using.
Okay, interesting. And real quick, when you say this other form of cryptography was not very trusted, and you sort of just answered it too, is the reason for that you're saying it used certain it used a certain set of unproven assumptions that because they're not proven,
right,
we don't We don't know. Okay. So I'm just always curious by stuff like that. Okay.
They're actually impossible to prove. We're just assuming that no efficient algorithm exists to break this. And the assumptions made for pairing crypto are a bit stronger than for elliptic curve crypto.
Okay, interesting.
So this is just newer. This crypto that we're using in Mimblewimble, is it rely on the discrete logarithm problem, which is...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The elliptic curve discrete logarithm problem.
Okay, like you said, which Bitcoin relies on as well. Okay.
Yes.
And so what then are the implications of combining all transactions into one in a single block?
So the implication of combining all the transactions is that the transaction graph, which is just a sort of technical way of describing all the inputs and all the outputs of every transaction. So when somebody creates a transaction, you can see money went in, money went out. The transaction graph is no longer has tons of transactions in it, where if you learn a little bit about some transaction, you can sort of follow the history backwards and forward from whatever you know and learn a lot.
So this is exactly the same thing as what a coin join in Bitcoin itself tries to accomplish. The difference is for coin join, the participants that jointly create a transaction all need to know and collaborate and be online at the same time. And what Mimblewimble allows is to do anyone on the network can take any two transactions and combine them. So it simplifies this massively and goes way further.
Okay, so it's not automatic. You're saying the users still have to take steps to do this combining?
No. Every node on the network could do it automatically, which is not possible with CoinJoin.
I see. So that is a huge advantage. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so that's actually only half of Mimblewimble. So this in itself is pretty spectacular that you can get this OWASP kind of thing without pairing-based cryptography, without any fancy new assumptions.
Okay, is this the Nimble then or the Wimble that we just discussed? I'm sorry, I'm being silly. Go ahead, sorry.
So the second part is that what this allows you to do, and I think OWASP could maybe have been coerced into doing this, but the Mimblewimble definitely does, is lets you take, if you have a series of blocks, then somebody can give you, if you want to validate all those blocks, they can give you, rather than every single full block with every transaction, they can give you, as Peter said, just the effect on the blockchain of all of those blocks put together. So if sometimes a transaction had an output, and in a later block that output was spent, that output just doesn't appear. You can delete that from the data, give the data with all this missing stuff to somebody, and they can do full verification. And this is not true in Bitcoin.
Specifically, this actually means that the concept of a blockchain could shrink. We could have a block that spends more than it creates, and as a result, the entire blockchain would shrink. The amount of data I need to give you to prove that the state of the ledger is correct could theoretically go down over time, while in Bitcoin it's just we append blocks all the time.
So it's not just that the blockchain itself would grow at an incrementally smaller pace compared to Bitcoin. You're saying then that even the full amount of data in the blockchain over time could go down.
So Ethereum sort of has something like this. So they have the their equivalent of the UTXO set in the Patricia Merkle tree.
You should maybe explain that for listeners.
Okay.
Well, if you can't, it's a cryptographic thing,
right? There's a bit of a difference here in that the UTXO set is what we call the state of the ledger, like knowing how much money everybody has. That's what we call the UTXO set. And in Bitcoin, you could do this as well. I could give you the UTXO set, and you wouldn't need to verify the history if you trust me. But if you don't trust me, you actually need to see all blocks in history to verify that this state of the ledger is actually correct. And in Mimblewimble, the data that I need to show you to prove, not just you don't trust me, I can actually prove it that it's correct, can go down over time.
Yeah, and importantly, Ethereum does not change that. What Ethereum does with its commitments is it says, well, now you're trusting a miner who maybe did a lot of proof of work, so maybe it's a bit more trustworthy than some random stranger. But you're still ultimately trusting that miner that the state of the chain is what it is. With Mimblewimble, there's no trust. It's as though you had downloaded the entire blockchain and verified all of it, but you don't.
Wow. And then so as far as not just the blockchain but the block size, I assume this also means in practice that there would be no need to increase the block sizes with Bitcoin as far as transactions per 10 minutes or whatever. Because in practice, there's just so little data going across.
So that's a bit complicated. In real time, all of the data still have to go across. It's only for people who join later, they get to reap the benefits of all this deleted data. So I can give you the full Bitcoin history, or not Bitcoin, but some Mimblewimble coin. I can give you the full Mimblewimble coin history, but that would be very small. But then while you're watching the network, you still have to see every single block in real time. It's just so you can delete some stuff and it doesn't matter.
So you still have every, like, if you have 100 million transactions in a block, you still have to, like, go through all that data. It's just once that's done, the history of that data can be pared down, right? Or is that right?
You have to keep up with the fire hose in real time, but it evaporates away later.
I hate your analogies. No, I'm just kidding. No, I like that. That's good. That's good. I like that. That's good.
The thing is, part of this evaporation happens within a single block. If I send you some money and you spend it, and both of those transactions go into the same block, this me sending you money and you taking it cancels out against each other, and it just doesn't appear in the chain anymore.
I see. Okay. So, that is a good analogy.
Does this mean now we need to have two transactions? So someone needs to send me money and I need to take money?
Oh, no. So I'm talking about transaction output and transaction inputs. So okay. It's if I were to send you money and you were to send it on, so there are two, we're just trying to do two transactions, but they can get merged together. And not only can they get merged together, the part where I send you and the part where you take it cancels out. So the joint transaction of those two is smaller than the sum of the individual transactions.
Interesting. It's a lot. I mean, it is and it isn't a lot to wrap your head around because we're so used to the...
It's very different from how Bitcoin works. So
exactly. We're so used to the... We have this sort of mental inertia of how we understand Bitcoin. That it's a little difficult to wrap our heads around this, but so it makes sense. It's interesting. Go ahead, Brian.
Is this going to have to be an interactive protocol? So in CoinJoin, I need to be in real-time communication with the people who I'm mixing with. Do I need to be in real-time communication with anyone to make one of these transactions?
You have to be in communication with the person you are sending to, but nobody else. So you make a transaction with the person you're sending to, and that requires a bit of interaction. But once the two of you make that transaction, it goes out there, and it can be merged with any other transaction with no more interaction involved.
So not every transaction, then, is guaranteed to be merged. It has to be actively done between sender and receiver?
Well, one of the rules in the Mimblewimble paper is that
let's talk about that on the other side. I hate to cut you off, but we are coming to break. Andrew Polstra and Peter Willa and Brian Deere will be right back, guys.
Would you like to...
Don't worry, folks. If you missed the latest episodes of The Crypto Show, you can always catch the replays on Tuesdays and Fridays on BitcoinTalkRadio.com, as well as the latest news in the Bitcoin space. That's BitcoinTalkRadio.com, or just find them on the TuneIn app.
Of trustless technologies like Bitcoin and similar things. Welcome back, guys, to the Crypto Show here on this lovely August 7th, 2016, a Sunday. We're sitting in studio with Brian Deere, Chief Scientist of Factum, also known as Dances with Wolves, and Peter Willa and Andrew Polstra, two cryptographic experts. One of whom apparently lives in town. We'll have to have him on the show in person if he's willing in the future for more updates on our current topic, Nimblewimble. Did I get that right?
No.
Yep. For sure. Anytime I'm in town, guys.
Yeah, we'd love to, definitely. Mimblewimble. Mimblewimble. And having a cryptographic expert is really cool because, you know, with something like Bitcoin, you know, Danny and I are no experts ourselves, but we're very grateful and fortunate to have experts come on our show to enlighten us and our listeners about all of these arcane aspects to what is a wonderful technology and related technology of technologies as well. But that cryptographic stuff is always something that is a little bit missing with people we have on. So it's a sort of a key element that is nice to fill in. And I think in a future episode, we'd love to explore that more. So that's exciting stuff. And we are exploring it, but on a slightly different topic. But let's see, when we were coming to break, was it Peter, were you... Andrew or Peter, I forget, was trying to say something on the way out. I don't know if either of you guys remember what that might have been.
I don't.
Okay.
Sorry, well, it took so long.
Let's see. If not, I do know that Brian had...
talking about the block size? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, we were getting to your question, but there was something related to it beforehand. Okay. Well, it'll come to us. So in that case, then, okay. Brian, you had a really good question about multiple assets using this technology.
Okay, sure. So in the sidechains paper, there was a talk of having multiple assets in a single sidechain. So you could have a Dogecoin sidechain and a Bitcoin sidechain. And then inside that sidechain, you would have atomic swaps, which are basically trustless. But that relied on everything pretty much being transparent. But now not having transparency, is multiple assets, can you have multiple assets in the same ledger with this technology?
Sure. So in something like Blockstream has this sidechain called Elements Alpha, which only supports Bitcoin, but it uses something called confidential transactions, which is a way of encrypting amounts, which what do I want to say? It's a way of encrypting amounts where you can still verify that the transaction is valid. And it would be possible if you had asset tags on this for verifiers to just say, well, which inputs have a certain asset type and which outputs have a certain asset type, and just add those up and make sure that they total to zero. Or that, you know, for every single asset, nothing else, nothing was created or destroyed. So you check each asset individually. So the way that Mimblewimble works is it uses confidential transactions. It uses it in some creative ways, but these ways are not too creative as to prevent asset tags from working. So you'd have two transactions which each individually don't create or destroy any assets. And after you merge them, they still don't create or destroy any assets. So the result is everything is still merged together. The amounts are still encrypted, but the assets then would not be in this scheme. But they're perfectly compatible with each other.
The assets would not be, what, encrypted? Or what were you...
The amounts would still be encrypted, but you would be able to tell each output and what asset it is, but you wouldn't see how much.
I see. Okay, just to clarify that. Okay, excellent.
And improving upon that is something we're working on. But I guess the baseline answer to your question is there is this conflict between how in a blockchain we make everything public because we think it's the only way that things can be verified. And this turns out to be false. Like usually we try to build protocols where you don't need to reveal things and still be able to verify. And confidential transactions is one of them, but Mimblewimble does the same thing.
Well, and so having said that, can Mimblewimble be applied to Bitcoin? Can it be introduced into the protocol or added as a layer on top? Or would it instead operate as a potential competing cryptocurrency?
So it works very different from how Bitcoin works, and introducing it into Bitcoin in a backward compatible way would be a difficult exercise. Maybe not impossible, but it would be hard. I think the way if people would start experimenting with this, I would expect it to be a experimental separate blockchain or a sidechain. And in case it's a sidechain, we don't introduce a new cryptocurrency, but we do introduce a separate chain in which maybe here it's also important to note that there are downsides to Mimblewimble. In particular, it does not have a scripting language.
For those who may not know the implications of that, why is that a bad thing?
So there's something we've probably talked about on the show before, the so-called Lightning Network, or something called payment channels, which are ways of doing transactions off-chain. And those are, in the Mimblewimble paper, those are not supported. I think that I can get payment channels to work, actually. But there are a number of things that Bitcoin can do using a scripting language. A big one is payment channels. Another one is cross-chain atomic swaps, where I could, for example, trade with Brian some Dogecoin for some Bitcoin. And Dogecoin and Bitcoin have nothing to do with each other, right? I mean, their blockchains don't talk, but we could still trustlessly swap these using something called a cross-chain atomic swap. And the reason is that both Dogecoin and Bitcoin have this very expressive scripting language. And so you can find sorts of trickery that will let you do things like this. And Mimblewimble cannot. And I don't see any way to make Mimblewimble able to do that, actually. And there are lots of other examples I can think of. But Bitcoin can do a lot of stuff beyond just, like, transferring money between people.
Yeah, the nice thing about Bitcoin scripting language and other cryptocurrencies with expressive scripts is that people end up doing things with it that it was not designed for. Like, nobody had thought of cross-chain atomic swaps or lightning when Bitcoin was invented, and yet it requires no changes to the protocol or at the scripting level, at least there were some. Having a relatively expressive language in transactions allows much easier experimentation by doing things it was not designed for. And this would be much harder in Mimblewimble. It's basically just sending money that it can do. It can do things like multi-signatures and a few others, but it's much more limited in its possibilities.
So can it do multi-signatures that are exclusive, like two of three, or is it just two of two type of multi-sig?
Yes. And any of them, but larger ones require a lot of interaction between the participants. In worst case scenarios, I think exponentially so. things like Bitcoin, yes, definitely. if we're just talking about multi-sig on a small scale like Bitcoin does, yes. It doesn't go as far as what we could do with Schnorr or Keytree signatures.
And so just to clarify then, because Bitcoin has an expressive scripting language, it has a lot of versatility compared to Mimblewimble, which is very sort of narrow in scope in what it can do, although it's very good at what it does. But it doesn't have the sort of flexibility to be adapted to other things like Bitcoin. Is that what you're trying to say, basically? Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of a good thing to know. I mean, not that it would be a bad thing if it were otherwise, but it's not in, say, direct competition with Bitcoin. It can share the space with Bitcoin.
There's an argument to be made that an expressive scripting language is sort of inherently a privacy and fungibility risk to the system, in that, say, tomorrow awesomewalletservice.com opens and they're the only one in the Bitcoin space that use a 3 out of 7 multisig. Now you can identify every transaction on the blockchain that uses awesomewallet.com because they're the only ones that use 3 out of 7. So a scripting language is very neat to play with, but it has a privacy downside, and where Mimblewimble takes this to completely the other side, where you have very, very good privacy, but the result is you can't have that many features anymore.
And so just to clarify, in what you're saying, is the downside because the ledger shows, the ledger's pseudonymous?
Yes, exactly. The scripts go into the blockchain, so if you want a transaction to be indistinguishable from another one, well, if you use a different script, you've already failed.
Okay, gotcha. Well,
there was a
little bit of talk about Zcash in one of our news minutes.
Crypto Compare news minutes.
One of those ones, yeah. is this crypto that makes this up? Is this, would you guys trust this any more or less than the crypto that underlies Zcash?
So the cryptography that Zcash relies on is a snark, and I think, and Andrew knows this better than I do, it's also pairing-based, but it requires a trusted setup, I think. There's sort of a ceremony where a number of people need to come together and create a private key for the system itself and then destroy it. And anyone who has this key can basically do what they want in the system. So that's what is called a trusted setup, and that is something that Zcash has that Mimblewimble does not.
Very interesting. Well, we're coming to break, and we've had a really good discussion about a fascinating new cryptographic protocol called Nimblewimble.
So something that we talked about in the last break, are there any signatures in this Mimblewimble protocol?
That sounds like that needs either a bit of thought to answer. So let's leave it in suspense a little bit since we're coming to break, and we can answer that on the other side with Andrew Polstra and Peter Willa and Brian Deary. And fascinating stuff. I'm very excited about this episode, and you should too. So you should tune back in after this break. We'll be right back.
Oh, for the longest time. Oh, for the longest time. If you said that Bitcoin was my life, I would tell you.
Show enough, show you right.
Guys, welcome back to the Crypto Show here on this lovely August 7th, 2016, Sunday. And don't forget that we come to you always through Logos Radio Network. Check out all the other wonderful programming, or deprogramming, if you will, on logosradionetwork.com. And, of course, don't forget our other sponsors, Hill Country Home Improvements, for all your roofing needs. The only roofer that I know of in the entire galaxy that accepts and prefers Bitcoin. And don't forget Crypto Compare with our Crypto Compare News Minute. Let's see, where's the next one? Credits becomes UK's first official blockchain provider for public services. That was almost kind of a alliterative, like a, what do you call that? She sells by the seashore. I can't do it. Credits, the London-based blockchain as a service, BaaS platform, is now under the G-Cloud 8 framework agreement for use in the UK public sector, meaning that organizations like schools, hospitals, governments, charities, and emergency services will be able to use credits to build blockchain solutions, which can be used by these services to become more efficient. And so it's amazing how even governments are adopting blockchain stuff. I mean, it's really coming into its own, you know, and it's only been what? When was the paper released? 2009? The white paper? The blockchain?
Block, yeah, that's right.
Bitcoin.
2008.
2008.
Or, sorry, 2008. I knew that. Man, it comes a long way, though, in only a matter of years. Anyway, let's get back to our guests. It's Peter Willa and the Chuck Norris of cryptography, and Chuck Norris number two of cryptography, Andrew Polstra. This is according to Brian Deary. And, of course, Brian Deary, our local resident expert in all things technical, without whom we would be floating at sea without a compass, many a show here on the Crypto Show. But of course, we're talking about Nimblewimble, close enough. a fascinating new technology, and talking about its strengths, also its weaknesses, which is a fair point to bring up. You know, everything has its limitations as far as what it can do, but what it can do is very powerful and I think very necessary for both data, I don't want to say compression, but for minimizing data, and of course for maximizing privacy. Brian, you had a point to make, or you had a question for one of the guys as went out. Do you recall what that was again?
So there was some talk in the break about does this use signatures? I guess is not an easy question. So, do you guys want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Do you want to take this, Peter?
Sure. So, yes, it definitely uses digital signatures, but more in an implicit way. Like there is no, opcheck-sig and no, script-sig in Nimblewimble. So in Bitcoin, signatures are sort of very explicit. You say, I expect a signature here, and you verify it. In Nimblewimble, they're more just part of the transaction structure. I guess this is not a very useful answer. I guess the answer is yes.
Well, is there a way that you can maybe elaborate on that or clarify that? To explain that better, or is it kind of such a deep, thorny issue?
So my unpacking of this is that it maintains this state, and then cryptographic operations, which are similar to the Bitcoin signatures that we all know and love, transform from one state to the other state. However, that's not really. You can go from the first state to the last state without all the things in between it, and they all just kind of morph. All the morphs are squished together into a single. Go from the beginning to the end very quickly.
Maybe here's one way to think about it. In Bitcoin, everything uses digital signatures. What a digital signature does is just says somebody authorizes some sort of state transition. So to spend a coin, either some key related to that coin, you sign a message saying this coin is no longer a coin. Now there's a new coin that somebody else owns who has a different key, and that's how you sign stuff. But these signatures, they just take some arbitrary data and basically sign it. I mean, they authorize something. There's no real mathematical connection between the output and the input in a normal signature scheme. And what Nimblewimble does is it does make the inputs and outputs mathematically related, but in a way that you can't actually make a transaction unless you know a secret key. So, I mean, this is kind of a signature in some sense.
Maybe important to add, there are no addresses in Nimblewimble.
Oh. Yes, that too.
You just talk directly to the receiver and you jointly construct the transaction as you're talking.
Yeah,
and there are private and public keys and signatures involved there, but it's not like I create an output to this address and then to spend it, I sign off using that address. It's more deeper, I guess, inside the engine.
So how do I know how many Mimblewimble coins I have then if I don't have an address?
Ah, well, basically you want to receive some coins. You construct a part of a transaction with the amounts in it and then give it to the sender to create it. So you know how much is in there because that's what you put there.
Okay, so is there no concept of change anymore, or minor fees or anything like that?
Oh yeah, that definitely still exists. Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine I'm trying to send Brian some money. When we create our transaction jointly, I make a transaction that's got a bunch of inputs and some change. Brian then adds to that transaction some outputs that he created of the value that he wanted. And then we can also leave some value sitting on the table there. Just send the transaction out. And then anybody can go add another output and take the remaining value. So what this means is miners can basically take their own fees, more or less. So at each stage of creating a transaction, you sort of create the part of the transaction that you want to authorize and that you know how to create. And then the other parties, I guess the recipient, tax on some outputs that they know the value of, and then they can that they can take ownership of, and then other nodes can take fees, or the miners can take fees, or something. And basically, any floating value there, you have to say what the floating value is explicitly, but then anybody can take some of that, and they won't be able to make the transaction add up if they try to take more than there is available. So there's sort of this neat thing where everybody can sort of everyone receiving coins gets to make their part of the transaction, basically.
And so I think a lot of this is still working in my brain. But so these transactions between two people are still broadcast to the network? Like,
so you need to broadcast the transaction and the leftover fees that someone can then calculate. Would the transaction be valid if there wasn't enough, if it wasn't exactly inputs and outputs? If the balances didn't match? Okay.
It has to match exactly. So the amounts in the inputs must be exactly equal, not more, not less, as the amounts in the output plus the fee you declare. And if the number is not exactly the same, the transaction is invalid and verifiably invalid.
And how long does it take for it to be verifiably invalid? And does that mean, so obviously the transaction doesn't go through, and how long does that take?
Any millisecond.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I think nanoseconds, so no, I'm kidding. Okay, well, interesting. Well, we're coming to break again. Interesting stuff. We're going to have some more questions on the other side with Brian Deary. And, of course, our guests, Andrew Polstra and Peter Willa, talking about Nimble Wimble, or close enough. And we'll be right back, so stay tuned, guys. All right, guys, welcome back to the second to last segment of the Crypto Show here on this lovely August 7th, 2016, a Sunday. And before we get back to our discussion, let us never, ever forget the Crypto Compare News Minute. Let's see. We have a Bitfinex hack update. Bitfinex has recently stated that it plans to socialize, the losses among Bitcoin holders. Socialism has always worked. It is still unclear what this means exactly, but one can assume that the losses are to be distributed by all users and not just the holders of the affected wallets. Bitfinex announced on its website, "We are still working out the details. However, we are leaning towards a socialized loss scenario among Bitcoin balances and active loans to BTC USD positions." That would be a fun, not for this show, but that would be a fun sort of philosophical slash economic slash political discussion for one or two of our segments on an upcoming show while it's still relevant. Because it really is. I mean, As these things happen with Ethereum and other things, I mean, you're seeing a lot of very political decisions being made. And as we've discussed in the past year, even stuff that seems more technical, like the block size debate, is really underneath a very philosophical and political debate more than anything. So definitely factors into all this. So anyway, but let's get back to our discussion. We're talking about Mimblewimble. I got it right this time, I believe. And Brian, what were we discussing on the way out?
Oh, one of Peter's Chuck Norris powers was he knows what Mimblewimble was. I got it wrong.
That's right. And Peter, say again, what is it in Harry Potter? It's explain it again.
Well, I actually learned this from Andrew.
Well, Andrew, you go ahead. You're the source. You'll say it best.
Okay, sure. I mean, I also learned it this week, but not from anyone in this room. So I guess I'm the source here.
Sorcerer.
Yeah, I'm the source.
Ah, that was good. We always love good puns on the Crypto Show. Peter Willa takes the cake. He is the number one punster for the show. That was really good. Anyway, go ahead.
So what Mimblewimble does in Harry Potter is it prevents somebody from saying some sort of information. Like just any sort of information. And this was used in the books where, you remember, like, before the first book even happened, Harry's parents were killed. And they were part of some group called the Order of the Phoenix. And they were being hidden in some house whose location was secret. And the Order of the Phoenix used this Mimblewimble spell on each other to make sure none of them could reveal the location of this house. And so they were magically unable to give away the secret location.
It's interesting. Basically, it's like they had a secret society, and instead of blood oaths to keep the secrets, they just cast spells on each other to prevent it. I like that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a perfect name for the protocol.
Yeah, right, no, like, exactly.
I really loved how earlier this week we had totally serious discussions with sentences like, "So what Voldemort thought of?"
And that's the beauty of the crypto space is all the brilliant minds still love their Harry Potter and bringing in the Harry Potter terminology. And what did you say again? In France, they called Voldemort what?
Okay, I might be saying this wrong, but the name is Tom Elvis Judasaur, which is an anagram of Je suis Voldemort.
So wow, there was a scene it's an anagram in the second,
yeah. There is a scene in I guess the second movie, but also the second book, where Voldemort like conjures up these letters and says, "I am Lord Voldemort." And then these letters rearrange themselves, and it turns out to be an anagram of, he says, "Tom Marvolo Riddle" is his name. And he rearranges these letters, and it turns into, "I am Lord Voldemort." So in the French books, they needed a name that would anagram to Je suis Voldemort. And what they came up with was Tom Elvis Jeu de Sort, like Jeu de Sort, game of sorts, I guess.
and that's what the author of the Mimblewimble paper called himself.
That is so awesome. That is amazing. I love the French. My French friends actually just came into town this past month to visit. It was a fun experience. I need to go to them. I've still never been to France. But Brian, it looks like back to serious matters.
Okay.
You got a good question. Go ahead.
And a rant. Okay.
So
this, it's the state itself that we advance slowly over time. There was a proposal called Flipping the Chain way back when. I believe it's attributed to Alan Reiner, but it was only using UTXO commitments, and so it was the state of the chain, which is kind of what Ethereum is right now. And then on to my rant about Alan Reiner. It's really sad. He, with the Armory wallet, he's now working for he's shifted to the dark side, all this talk of Voldemort.
What do you mean?
He's now working for IronNet Cybersecurity, which is Keith Alexander's cybersecurity company. He was the director of the NSA for a decade until 2014.
Oh, no way. Really? Oh,
yeah.
Okay, that's so scary.
Wow.
And so this this kind of falls in with a lot of other wallet providers who have turned to the dark side. Jan Moeller is now one of the founders of Chainalysis, which is working to de-anonymize. He's the original founder of Mycelium.
Really? And they're working to de-anonymize what?
Well, not Mycelium itself, but the original author of Bitcoin Spinner.
Okay.
Turned into Mycelium.
I see.
And So the dark side is strong in with us.
But he's working on a project to de-anonymize. You didn't finish
Bitcoin transactions. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what is the purported advantage or benefit to that?
Well, if you want to track flows of money.
Well, fair enough. But I mean, if you're not the government, basically, I mean, I guess you could find maybe corporate reasons for doing this.
Sure, yeah.
Or other private reasons.
A government can force businesses to use services like this to make sure that the money they get isn't stolen or something. And
good call.
My attitude towards such services is that they're great because they give us a target. Our job in developing the system is to make their job impossible.
So, you mean with Mimblewimble?
For example, yes.
Exactly.
So there's various other things, but you can't blame people for trying to things that are possible. So they show us what is possible, so we have a target to improve upon.
No, exactly. I like that. Exactly. They give you more purpose for a project like Mimblewimble. Exactly.
So, as a corollary to this, though, one of the benefits of Bitcoin is I can provably show that I have paid someone some money, cryptographically proven them. If I make one of these transactions, will I be able to cryptographically show that I paid some money to someone, even though it was anonymous?
Yes. Yeah, you can. So the way this is done, basically, is when, say I'm sending you some money, when you and I are talking to build this transaction, you need to create an output for this transaction. And part of this output is a part of confidential transactions called a range proof that you have to make on that output. And to make this, you need to use the secret key for that output. So as soon as I see that output, I know that you are in control of that key. And then when I build the whole transaction, I know that output is your output because I was with you when we built the transaction together. Then we send it out, this whole thing is sort of built together. And then what shows up in the block is, you know, a whole bunch of inputs, a whole bunch of outputs, a bunch of merged transactions that you can't separate. But I can see that one of the outputs in that merged transaction is the one that you gave me when we were talking. So that's in the blockchain, and I can see that, and we both have the transcript of our conversation.
Can I prove it to a third party as a sender?
Yes.
Yeah.
You can show the transaction and show that it was linked in the chain. So this is usually the trade-off that I think is optimal, where the public does not see things, but you always have the ability to prove to an auditor or whatever happened. So like it's voluntary.
That makes sense. All right, we'll come back on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. All right, guys, welcome back to the final segment of the Crypto Show here on this lovely Sunday, August 7th, 2016, on Logos Radio Network, brought to you as always by Hill Country Home Improvements and Crypto Compare with the Crypto Compare News Minute. And our last one will be Gatecoin to reopen during August. A new announcement was made today by Gatecoin, in which the details regarding the exchange's plans to resume trading activity are described. Gatecoin will reopen on Wednesday, August 17th at 8 General Mountain Time, and there will be no trading fees until September 1st, 2016, in an effort to draw back clients to the Hong Kong-based exchange. New assets like Augur and Digix DAO tokens will be available, as well as the fiat currency CNY. Users will also be allowed to withdraw 10% of their ETH holdings that were stored on Gatecoin at the time of the hack, while the other 90% are considered Ethereum debt. Gatecoin explains through an official blog post, quote, "We cannot confirm an exact date when ETD will be reconciled with ETH. However, we continue to work towards repaying the total amount and are still committed to ensure that all clients receive their funds in full." All right, we're getting back to our guests, Andrew Polstra and Peter Willa. And, of course, we also have Brian Deary in studio with us. I do want to take a quick side track into a cryptographically related topic, but not necessarily what we've been talking about. As we talked about off air, I wanted to know if you guys had any opinions on or what you knew about the memo from a year ago, as Brian was telling you off air, that the NSA put out, basically discouraging people from upgrading to elliptic curve cryptography from RSA if they hadn't done so already, sort of implying that it wasn't worth it. And the context of that was that the NSA expected advancements in quantum computing to make such a switch irrelevant. I believe that's what they were implying. But anyway, I'm just curious what you guys knew about that or what opinions you had on that. And also, as Brian was explaining, there were two cryptographers, I forget their names, who kind of explored a game theoretic, basically different scenarios under which the NSA might make such an announcement, you know, basically what motives they had for it, they explored. Anyway, if y'all had any comments on that.
On the NSA, so my recollection of the NSA announcement, I had forgotten, I didn't read the part about RSA, but there was a recommendation as part of this to upgrade.
I just looked it up.
Oh, okay.
So this is from an article, I don't know the exact quote, but complementary to its decision to move away from elliptic curve crypto was also the NSA's deprecation of P256, blah, 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 believes RSA is more resistant to advances in quantum computing. So the claim is that there is some belief that especially the smaller elliptic curves would in the future potentially become vulnerable to quantum quantum computing. Whether that's the real reason, I don't know.
And, but yeah, you were kind of saying off air that then therefore maybe just go to bigger curves, and that would
with a few people we recently visited Stanford campus here a week ago and met with Dan Bonnet, who is a expert in elliptic curve crypto and other things, and he basically confirmed that even if quantum computers were real, there's a chance that they would not be able to attack larger elliptic curves while still be able to attack smaller ones. At least that was my understanding from what he said. So go on.
No, sorry. And would the reason just for that be in the same sense that with any kind of cryptographic breaking, even with quantum computing, the bigger curves would simply just take too much time.
Yeah,
the sort of brute force.
The usual assumption is that if we had a large, fast quantum computer, then all of elliptic curve crypto would break instantly. That's of course not how things actually work in engineering. We don't go from one day to another, from having no quantum computer to having a fully fledged, big, fast, stable, usable machine. But basically what I learned there was that there is some theoretical understanding that a quantum computer in practice may be able to break and completely break the security of smaller curves while not being able to break larger ones.
And is SEC-256K1 that Bitcoin uses, is that considered a small one or a big one?
That's a small one.
Mm. Oh, well.
as far as I know, the largest quantum computer that does something like 5 qubits or so for now, we'd need systems that have several hundreds or several thousand qubits machine to actually apply an attack to.
And on this note for the advancement, so Austin, UT Austin has recently had a big win in the quantum computing field. So Professor Scott Aronson has decided to move down and teach at UT Austin and set up a quantum calculation laboratory here at the university.
Wow, that's interesting.
They wouldn't give his wife tenure at MIT along with he already had tenure, and So they offered, he wanted his wife to
attend with him or to be with him.
Yeah. And so UT Austin gave both of them attending.
Good for UT. So, heck yeah. That sounds awesome. Screw you, MIT. That's pretty neat. Well, and that's interesting. I mean, we can never know the state of quantum computing because ultimately the government, as a sort of a priori rule, will never reveal the current state of its technological prowess. Why would any government do that? That's not to say that they do have quantum computing that's advanced, but it does make you wonder. Interesting stuff, though. Interesting response. And I guess the last thing is, too, we've got about 4.5 minutes. I've always been fascinated by Fermat's last theorem ever since I was, like, I think in high school. And I read a book a while back about Andrew Weil's proving Fermat's last theorem. And it had to do with elliptic curves, I know. And I'm just curious, in y'all's education in cryptography, what did Fermat's last theorem and its proof by Andrew Wiles, was that significant at all in the progress of cryptography?
The short answer is no. The long answer is I've tried to understand that proof by Andrew Wiles many times, and it starts from elliptic curve stuff. And actually, the whole history of Fermat's last theorem involves elliptic curves quite deeply. This is actually why elliptic curves were invented, why we have these what are called elliptic curve groups, which lets us do all sorts of fancy algebra and cryptography on these curves. All this machinery was actually invented largely to deal with Fermat's last theorem, among other algebraic equations that we didn't really understand.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep, that is true. And actually in the first chapter of most any general algebra book on elliptic curves, you'll solve like a couple of very special cases of Fermat's last theorem that happen to have very simple solutions with elliptic curves. But the most general form is it starts with elliptic curves and then it goes on to like higher level stuff and higher level stuff and higher level stuff probably 100 times. And I can't even begin to understand what I'm unable to begin to understand about that proof. So no, I mean
it took him 7 years to write it, right? It's not something you expect to like read over and say, oh sure, that's obvious.
Well, right, if it took 7 years to write, it could take 7+ years to read. And it's funny you say, I mean, the book itself said that like all of these brilliant mathematical minds had difficulty grasping it just because it is so arcane and so deep and so involved. So that's interesting. It's not surprising that like you go down one rabbit hole, not everyone can necessarily follow you without taking that same amount of time to go down that rabbit hole. So, interesting response. Yeah. It's something that's, you know, I got to AP calculus. That's about it. but still the really, higher order math and deeper stuff, especially cryptography, has always fascinated me. And so, I was just curious what, a genuine and very, preeminent cryptographer like the two we have on thought about that. So interesting response that it's a very arcane topic, but still related to cryptography. Well, we have a minute and a half left. Great discussion on Mimblewimble. Sorry, Mimblewimble. We've got a minute left, but guys, Andrew Polstra, Peter Willa, it's been a real pleasure. I know it has been a big pleasure for Brian Deary. He's a big fan of yours, and we're a big fan, too, now that we've had our introduction and gotten to know your expertise and this new protocol that's very interesting. But tell us where people can learn more about it.
So if right now, if you Google Mimblewimble Bitcoin, and just look for the Reddit threads about that, I think is probably the best way. You'll find the original paper there, which is not written in great English. I think this guy was actually French or something. And there are a few, it looks like the first hit from Reddit, if you just search for Mimblewimble Bitcoin. That's the place to go, I think. There's a bunch of discussion there. I'm there, Peter is there, there's a few other cryptographers there. That's my advice.
Well, excellent. Sounds pretty easy.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. Peter is not there.
Well, Peter is on the crypto show, so if you want to hear what he has to say about the topic, listen to this episode. If you're not listening to it live, check it in the archives. Guys, thank you so much.